The crowd did not wait for permission. By the time the sun dropped behind the tenement rooftops on September 23, 1998, hundreds of people had already sealed off the blocks around the Kingston Central Police Station. They brought tires and they brought fire. They threw stones. They fired guns into the air. They stopped traffic. They stopped commerce. They stopped the city. And they chanted one phrase over and over, loud enough that the officers on the upper floors of the station could hear it clearly through the walls. No Zeke's, no peace, no Zeke's. Kingston will continue to burn. This was not a spontaneous eruption. It was not random. It was a demonstration of loyalty, so concentrated, so organized in its fury, and so politically revealing that it stopped the country cold. Senior police officers came out onto the station balcony and pleaded for calm. A superintendent tried. The elected PNP councillor for the area, a man named Victor Cummings, who happened to be the half-brother of the man locked inside, stepped forward and appealed directly to the crowd. They booed him. They shunned him. They didn't want speeches from politicians. They wanted one man, and one man only. They wanted Zeke's. What happened next has become one of the most cited and most analyzed moments in the history of Jamaica's garrison system. Donald Zeke's Phipps was escorted to the balcony. He raised his hand. He told his supporters, through a bullhorn, that he was fine, that he was not being abused, and that they should go home. And they listened. Police officers, by multiple accounts, wept openly. Not from relief alone, from something deeper. From the sudden visceral understanding that the man they had arrested inside their own station commanded more authority over downtown Kingston in that moment than the entire Jamaican security apparatus standing around him. To understand how a man could hold that kind of power over a city, you have to go back before Zeke's. You have to go back to the street that made him and the brother who built the machine he inherited. Matthews Lane is not a long street. It sits in the heart of West Kingston, a dense pocket of low concrete buildings, zinc-roofed yards, narrow lanes, and generational poverty that has functioned as a political and criminal fortress for decades. Its roots as a garrison stretch back to the earliest years of Jamaican democracy. As early as 1947, a political organization called Group 69, named for the address at 69 Matthews Lane, was already being used as a mobilizing base for PNP enforcers during the bitter rivalry between Michael Manley's party and Alexander Bustamante's Jamaica Labor Party. The violence was so severe that Bustamante himself ultimately abandoned West Kingston as a political base, relocating to rural Clarendon. What remained in West Kingston was a community that had learned, at the very beginning of democratic Jamaica, that political loyalty and physical force were not separate things. They were the same thing. That lesson did not fade over generations. It deepened. By the 1960s and 1970s, the garrison model had become fully institutionalized. Housing, jobs, government contracts, and protection moved through political networks. The community leader was not merely an enforcer. He was a distributor of resources. He was a judge. He was a protector. And in Matthews Lane, that role through the 1970s and into the 1980s belonged to a man named Glenford Early Bird Phipps. Early Bird was the architect. He was the older brother, the one who built the Spangler's Posse from the streets of Matthews Lane into one of the most powerful Jamaican criminal organizations of the era, with operations running simultaneously in Kingston and New York City. The Spanglers carried strong PNP affiliation, a mirror opposite to the JLP-aligned Shower Posse, operating out of Tivoli Gardens across the invisible but absolute border of West Kingston. Early Bird surrounded himself with family. His brother Carl was reportedly named underboss. Donald, the youngest brother, the one who would become Zeke's, served as chief enforcer. His cousins Toywell Cow Phipps and Bulby Phipps were dispatched to New York to manage the gang's operations on the American end, running drugs through Englewood and other networks. The operation was family-run, politically protected, and expanding on both sides of the Atlantic. Then it broke. In 1977, Glenford "Early Bird" Phipps was killed. Reports indicate he died alongside two of his bodyguards, shot by rival posse members. The oldest Phipps brother, the founder, was gone, and the power of Matthews Lane, the Spanglers, the community control, the political relationships, the drug revenue, the guns, the loyalty and the fear, all of it transferred, in one violent moment, to Donald Phipps. He was not yet 30 years old. He had been enforcing. Now he would be ruling. What made Donald Zeke's Phipps different from his brother, and from most of the Dons who came before him in the garrison tradition, was not the level of violence he commanded. It was the confidence with which he wore his power in public. Zeke's did not hide. He did not operate in shadow, the way truly cautious criminals do. He stood in the street. He spoke to cameras. He gave interviews. He attended community events. He distributed school supplies. He scolded young men in Matthews Lane for carrying illegal guns, a gesture that worked on multiple levels simultaneously, because it signaled community care, while also demonstrating that the only man with the standing to set rules about weapons in that community was him. He positioned himself as a community leader, a father figure, a conflict resolver, and a businessman, while investigators and community members widely understood that his authority rested on the same foundation that had built every garrison in Kingston, violence and the credible threat of more. By the 1990s, Zeke's had consolidated Matthews Lane absolutely. Police believed he had built a substantial fortune through an extortion racket that taxed the businesses, transportation and commercial activity in the area. Where earlier Dons had drawn power primarily from political patronage and drug revenue, Zeke's had layered on an economic system that extracted tribute from the legal economy around him. Merchants paid, contractors paid, delivery drivers paid. The quiet tax on downtown commerce that flowed toward Matthews Lane was not random gang criminality. It was organized, systematic, and consistent. He also maintained peace, or something that functioned like it. For years through the 1990s, the relationship between Matthews Lane and Tivoli Gardens, the two great rival garrison communities of West Kingston, one PNP and one JLP, remained tense but not openly explosive. Zeke's was credited, by community members and by some law enforcement contacts, with helping manage that boundary and suppress outright warfare during periods when the political climate could easily have ignited it. His half-brother Victor Cummings was the elected PNP councillor for the area, a blood connection between the formal political system and the garrison's Don that was openly acknowledged but never publicly resolved. This was the garrison system functioning exactly as it had been built to function. The politician needed the Don's territory to produce votes. The Don needed the politician's connections to access government resources, receive advance warning of police operations, and maintain the appearance of community legitimacy. Neither relationship was hidden. Both parties simply refused to discuss it directly. And somewhere beneath that arrangement, never announced, never attributed publicly to any specific moment or conversation, was a question that never quite disappeared. Who exactly decided when Zeke's was protected and when he was not? Who made the calls that kept him free? When the police came, the connection existed. The wire was there. No one wanted to name the other end. The 1998 arrest was supposed to be a routine detention. On the night of September 23rd, police arrested Zeke's on charges that would later be formalized as illegal possession of a firearm, attempted murder, and wounding with intent. The specific circumstances of the original detention are not detailed in the primary record with full precision, but what followed was documented by every major Jamaican news outlet and most of the international correspondents paying attention to the island's political violence. Within hours of his arrest, the streets around Kingston Central Police Station had been locked down. Hundreds of supporters from Matthews Lane and the surrounding downtown communities formed an angry, organized mass. They set fires. They blocked roads. They threw stones at the station. They fired shots. The riot lasted 3 days. When it was over, 4 people were dead, 2 members of the security forces and 2 civilians. 8 others were injured. The elected counselor had tried. His own half-brother went to the balcony, and the crowd turned louder. The superintendent tried. The crowd turned louder. Every representative of institutional authority that appeared attempted to negotiate the crowd downward, and the crowd responded by escalating. It was not until Zeke's himself appeared, not until his face was visible, not until his voice was through the bullhorn, that downtown Kingston stopped burning. He was subsequently released, and that release, which was treated publicly as a routine legal development, was processed by the people of Matthews Lane as something else entirely. It was confirmation. Every resource of the Jamaican state, police, politicians, military infrastructure had come to him. He had spoken. They had gone home. And now he was free. He walked back into Matthews Lane, not diminished, but magnified. The peace that followed the 1998 riots held for less than 2 years. In May of 2000, war broke out between the Spanglers and the Shower Posse, between Matthews Lane and Tivoli Gardens. The long-suppressed rivalry between the PNP-aligned garrison and the JLP-aligned garrison ignited fully, producing a prolonged cycle of killings, reprisals, and territorial confrontations that claimed at least 7 lives in the initial outbreak. Peace meetings were called. Community leaders, clergymen, and political figures attempted to bring the 2 garrison leaders together. Zeke's, by multiple accounts, did not attend. He did not come to the table. He did not make the gesture. The man who had once been credited with maintaining stability in West Kingston was now, by his absence from every peace negotiation, making clear that he considered himself above the process. This was the first fracture in his mythology. The patron of downtown peace was not interested in peace when the terms were not his. Eventually, the violence subsided to a manageable level. Zeke's was summoned to Kingston Central Police Station, where officers met with him about the deteriorating security situation and reached informal agreements about managing the crime rate in his area. The violence cooled, and Zeke's came away from the experience with the same conclusion he appeared to draw from every confrontation with authority that had ended without consequences for him, that he was protected, that he was untouchable, that the system, the political system, the garrison system, the law enforcement system, would always find a way to accommodate him. That belief was not irrational. It had been confirmed repeatedly. The riots produced no criminal accountability for the mob that burned and killed in his name. The 1998 charges did not produce a conviction. The peace negotiations proceeded around him, not through him. Every time the system moved toward him, it stopped short. He had lived, for the better part of 2 decades, in a space where the rules that applied to ordinary Jamaicans simply did not apply to him. He began to act like it openly, posing for television cameras, boasting publicly about his power and influence, making himself visible in ways that, to those watching carefully, looked less like the confident authority of an untouchable man, and more like the overreach of someone who had confused survival with invincibility. There is a specific body that has never been fully explained. A man whose death in the early years of Zeke's reign was attributed, in various accounts, to gang enforcement, whose disappearance from Matthews Lane's story is neither confirmed nor cleanly resolved. That body is still there, quietly, in the background of every conversation about what Zeke's was really willing to do when loyalty was violated. It was not spoken about directly. It was never fully sourced to public record. But among the people who knew downtown Kingston, it was understood as the line he had crossed early, and crossed without hesitation. No one said his name publicly. No one had to. By 2004, the community that had protected him was beginning to fracture from within. 6 weeks before his October 2004, detention on suspicion of attempted murder, fighting broke out inside Matthews Lane itself, not between the Spanglers and the Shower Posse, but between Zeke's faction and a splinter group. A man named Victor Rooster Robinson, described in contemporaneous Jamaica Gleaner reporting as Zeke's former right-hand man, had defected, not merely left, but defected to Tivoli Gardens. This was not a neutral departure. It was a betrayal that carried tactical intelligence across enemy lines, from the PNP's most powerful West Kingston garrison, directly to the JLP's. The implications for Zex were severe. Someone who knew his operations, his alliances, his vulnerabilities, and his secrets had walked out of Matthews Lane and into the hands of his rivals. The Gleaner's October 2004 reporting made clear that the outbreak of fighting in the weeks following Robinson's defection was linked directly to this internal rupture. Zeke's was no longer governing a unified community. He was managing a fractured one, with an active threat operating from within the rival fortress a few blocks away. And then the murders happened. On April 16, 2005, the bodies of Dayton Scotchbright Williams and Rodney Farquharson were found in an open lot near Matthews Lane in West Kingston. They had been shot multiple times. Their bodies had been placed in a heap of tires and set on fire. The forensic evidence was unambiguous. They had died from multiple gunshot wounds before the burning. The burning was not an execution method. It was an attempt at concealment. Operation Kingfish, the specialist anti-gang unit that had been built specifically to target Jamaica's most powerful dons in the wake of years of political pressure to break the garrison system, moved immediately. Assistant Commissioner Glenmore Hines led 12 days of intensive questioning. On May 17, 2005, Donald Zix Phipps was arrested by senior detectives from the Criminal Investigation Bureau, pulled directly from the Corporate Area Resident Magistrates Court, where he had appeared on separate charges. This arrest did not produce a riot. The crowd that had gathered outside Kingston Central in 1998 and burned and killed for 3 days was not there this time. The streets were not blockaded. The tires did not burn. The change was not absolute. A stop order was placed on Phipps. His passport was seized, and he was fingerprinted and processed before being offered $1, 5 million bail. But the atmosphere around his arrest was fundamentally different from the mythological crisis of 1998. Part of that difference was the charges themselves. A firearms charge and a wounding charge could be managed, could be explained, could be framed as police harassment of a community leader. Two tortured, shot, and burned bodies were harder to frame. The community that had chanted for him in 1998 was now living in a Matthews Lane that had fractured, that had lost its right-hand man to Tivoli, that had watched internal violence between factions replace the unified front that had once made Zeke's authority feel absolute. The myth was still there, but something underneath it had shifted. The trial of Donald Zix Phipps for the murders of Dayton Williams and Rodney Farquharson was not a quiet proceeding. It began in March 2006 before Justice Horace Marsh and lasted 30 days. A co-accused, Garfield Williams, was discharged early after the prosecution conceded there was insufficient evidence to continue against him. That left Zeke's alone in the dock. The security concerns around the trial were acute and documented. During a bail application in November 2005, shots were fired near the Supreme Court, and a defense attorney, Alicia Thomas, was struck in the face by shotgun pellets while sitting in her office at 2224 Duke Street. She was treated at the University Hospital. The shooting was never definitively resolved in the public record, but its timing during active bail proceedings for one of Jamaica's most feared dons was not lost on the legal community or the Jamaican public. On April 12, 2006, after the judge's summation, the jury found Donald Phipps guilty of 2 counts of murder. He was sentenced to life imprisonment, with a minimum term of 30 years before parole eligibility. He was 48 years old. His defense had called one witness, David Foster, who testified that he had known Phipps for approximately 10 years and knew him as a community leader in Matthews Lane. The prosecution's case rested on forensic evidence, witness testimony, and cell phone records. One woman testified that she had seen Phipps at the scene. The judge in sentencing addressed Zeke's directly. Whether in that moment, Phipps registered the full distance between the balcony in 1998, the bullhorn, the crowd chanting his name, The Weeping Officers, and the dock in 2006 is something no record captures. What the record shows is that he immediately appealed. The appeal went to the Court of Appeal, which heard the case between January 11th and 14, 2010. On July 30th, 2010, the Court of Appeal dismissed it. Phipps then appealed to the highest court available to him, the United Kingdom Privy Council, which functions as Jamaica's final court of appeal. On June 24th, 2012, in a 9-page judgment, the Privy Council dismissed that appeal as well. The judgment confirmed that Phipps had no valid basis to challenge the verdicts of the High Court and the Court of Appeal. His argument had centered on voice recognition evidence and the claim that the jury's verdict could not be supported by the testimony. The Privy Council rejected both grounds. Donald Zeke Phipps was 58 years old. He was serving life imprisonment. He would not be eligible for parole until he was 78 at the earliest. The Matthews Lane he was trying to return to through those appeals no longer existed in the form he had ruled. In the vacuum left by his incarceration, the younger generation of lieutenants in the Spunglers had turned on each other. Men who had grown up entirely within the mythology of Zeke's, who had known no other order in their community, began competing for the fragments of authority his removal had left behind. Matthews Lane fractured the unified political and criminal infrastructure that had made the community a stable, if violent, force in West Kingston politics began to dissolve into smaller, more chaotic, less strategically coherent rivalries. The very stability that had made Zeke's valuable to the community, to the politicians, to the informal economic systems around him had depended entirely on his physical presence and his individual authority. It was not an institution. It was a man. And when the man was removed, what remained was not an organization. It was competing claims to a throne that the throne's architect was no longer available to adjudicate. What the 1998 riots revealed about Jamaica was not simply that a Don was popular. Popularity alone does not bring hundreds of people into the street to die for a man. What the riots revealed was something more structurally disturbing, that for significant sections of downtown Kingston's population, the state, the police, the courts, the politicians had so thoroughly failed to provide security, justice, economic access, and dignity that a garrison Don represented their most functional alternative institution. When they chanted "No Zeke's, no peace," they were not endorsing his criminal enterprises. They were expressing a genuine political reality that without him there was no one else to resolve disputes, distribute resources, or protect the community from the violence that the state either could not or would not prevent. The politicians who attended his hearings and appeared at his community events were not merely corrupt opportunists, though many were that too. They were navigating a system in which the garrison structure was the delivery mechanism for political loyalty. And without the Don, the votes could not be delivered. Victor Cummings, the half-brother who stood on the balcony in 1998 and was booed by a crowd that did not want him when they could have Zeke's, ran for parliament as the PNP candidate for Central Kingston in 2002. He made the pointed public statement that he would be the MP, not his brother. He was trying to draw a clean line between himself and the Don. The Gleaner noted dryly, in coverage of his 2006 parliamentary defeat to Ronnie Thwaites, that Matthews Lane was in walking distance of the constituency office, and that his brother, convicted of double murder, had been the area's reputed Don. The line between the politician and the Don was drawn in public, in speeches and in press releases. In practice, it was drawn in sand. And here, finally, is the question that was always underneath the surface of the Zeke story, the thread that ran from the 1970s to the 1998 balcony, to the 2006 verdict, to the dismissed Privy Council appeal, never fully resolved, never publicly attributed to any specific individual or meeting or political decision. The garrison structure that produced Zeke's did not produce him accidentally. Matthews Lane had been a political fortress since 1947. Group 69 had been organized with the support of PNP strategists. The Spangler's posse had been built by Early Bird Phipps, with, as multiple sources describe it, strong PMP affiliation. When Early Bird was killed and Zeke's took over, that affiliation did not break. It transferred. The political connection that gave Matthews Lane access to government resources, advanced knowledge, and protected space to operate did not expire with Early Bird's death. It updated its contact information and kept running. Through the 1990s, through the 1998 riots, through the peace negotiation failures of 2000, no official accountability was ever imposed on the political side of that arrangement. Politicians who received votes from Matthews Lane, who attended events in Matthews Lane, whose half-brothers were the Don of Matthews Lane, none of them were ever charged with anything related to the garrison structure they relied on. The missing accountability, the unanswered question about the other end of the wire, was never resolved. It remains unresolved. The Privy Council's 9 pages judged the murders of 2 men. They did not judge the system that produced the man who committed them. Zeke's did not die in a shootout. He was not killed by rivals the way Early Bird had been. He was not ambushed at a gas station or outside a bar in the night. He did not die in a police raid or a military operation. He was convicted in a court of law after a 30-day trial on the testimony of witnesses who were brave enough to speak, cell phone records that could not be made to disappear, and physical evidence the burning tires had failed to destroy. That matters. Not because the justice system that convicted him was clean. The shooting of a defense attorney during bail proceedings suggests otherwise. But because the method of his ending broke the garrison mythology in a specific way. Garrison dons in Jamaica's history had most often been removed through violence. They had been shot down, ambushed, neutralized by rivals or by the security forces in operations that rarely produced trials. Zeke's went through the courts. He was judged by Jamaican law, appealed to Jamaican courts, and appealed again to the Privy Council in London, and every level of that system said the same thing. He had always insisted he was a community leader. In the end, the community he had built was the thing that put him in the dock. The bodies were found near Matthews Lane. The witnesses who came forward had lived beneath his authority. The woman who said she saw him at the scene had watched him rule for years. He had spent decades making himself the only power in that community. And when the murders happened, the community was small enough and close enough that there was nowhere to hide inside it. The man who had silenced a riot with a single raised hand could not silence the evidence. The mythology that had terrified police officers into tears could not terrify a jury past the facts. The crowd outside Kingston Central in 1998 had chanted that without Zeke's, Kingston would burn. What they had not understood, what the garrison system, with all its terrible clarity, had never taught its beneficiaries, was that it was already burning. It had been burning since 1947. The fire was the foundation. And the man who walked to the balcony and told his people to go home had not built them a community. He had built them a cage with himself as the only key, and then spent his life convincing them that the cage was protection. When the cage closed around him at last, it closed around them too. That is the real weight of the Zeke story, not the 1998 balcony. Though that moment will never fully leave the Jamaican public imagination. Not the 30-day trial, not the 9-page Privy Council judgment, not the minimum 30 years. The real weight is the Matthews Lane that came after fractured, leaderless, its younger men turning on each other in a community that had been so completely organized around one man's authority that it had never learned to exist without it. The unnamed body, from the early years of his reign. The man whose death was never fully explained, whose name was understood but never spoken at full volume in public, had once been the proof of what Zex would do to those who challenged the order. It became, finally, a foreshadowing of the order itself, a thing consumed, when the time came, by the same fire it had used to maintain control. The bullhorn went quiet. The street did not.